Subcommittee. Today is Tuesday, February 22nd, 2005. Paul, welcome, Anne Marie. And we are going to go ahead and get started. And fortunately, since I'm still talking from the opening gavel, Representative Schaffler doesn't have to pay a fine.
Oh, good. Thank you, sir.
But as of today, for the record, anyone who is late from here on out, including the well, I won't say the chair, but
you have reasons to be late.
Absolutely, is going to have to pay a fine, and we will put that in the kitty to reimburse Anne Marie for the great goodies that she gives us. We do appreciate that. And so, with that out of the way, let's move forward. We're hearing the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife budget today. And if Director Ball and Lisa would like to come forward.
Mr. Chair, I really like the first letters I see. Why the agency exists.
You know, that's important to have right up front, isn't it?
It sure is.
Tells us exactly why they're here. Welcome, Director Ball, and for the record, state your name, please.
Chair Krupp, members of the committee, my name is Lindsey Ball. I'm the director of the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife.
And Director Ball, again, welcome. We're going to go through the overview, and then we will move right into performance measures, at least as far as we can get today. And again, feel free to ask questions. We have this budget for 2 days. And then hopefully tomorrow we'll conclude with performance measures and prioritization and reductions. And I, of course, have to be more gentle on Director Ball than most because he is also my constituent. So he has additional power over me than perhaps others do not.
And I will pray for him.
We are. Welcome, Senator Shields. Great to have you with us today. How are you feeling?
Well, I've been watching you goof off.
Well. Okay, so have you heard anything?
I've been listening since the tape went on.
Okay.
I've been watching you on television. I mean, you know, I'm watching you and I'm listening on the phone. I'm doing as much as I can do.
Okay, very good. So at the suggestion of Representative Krieger, we have decided to institute a fine system for members who are late. It's good-natured humor, and it will actually go into the kitty to reimburse Anne Marie for the great goodies that she seems to be leaving us every day here. But that doesn't apply to you, Senator.
Well, I think it's a fine.
I knew you were going to say that. All right. Thank you, Senator, for joining us, and we have Director Ball in front of us here. Director, please get started. Thank you.
I appreciate the opportunity today. As noted by Representative Krieger and yourself, Mr. Chair, why does the agency exist? As with many agencies, with all agencies, the agency exists as a result of statutory mandate. There are three statutes in particular that I noted in your handout. One is what defines wildlife in the state as meaning fish, wild birds, amphibians, reptiles, and other wild mammals. In addition to that, I want to bring to everyone's attention ORS 496-012, which is the wildlife policy of the state, and also ORS 506-109, which is the food fish policy of the state that pertains to the commercial fish industry. Those two statutes, I can't think of a time when the commission has come together where there hasn't been reference to those two statutes that were passed by this legislative body and to provide guidance and direction to our commission as they deliberate allocations, opportunities, recreational benefits, and security to private landowners. They're very important to us, and I hope at your leisure that you take some time to look through those statutes specifically. In addition to that, there are programs statutorily assigned to the agency in the Fish Division. And I might mention before I get into those specific programs, both the Fish Division and Wildlife Division are the only two divisions specifically mentioned in statute that will be a division of this agency. I think it's important to note that our legislators felt that this agency and those two respective divisions were important enough to mention in statute. They will always be a division in this agency unless the statute is changed. But inside the fish division, there's interjurisdictional fisheries, marine resources, natural production, propagation. Within the wildlife division, there's the wildlife diversity section, federal aid and landowner assistance, and the game program. Information and education division holds one statutory program, which is hunter safety education. And statutory administration activities are carried out by the commission, the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission, the director's office, administrative services division, human resources division, information and education, and information systems division. And with respect to law enforcement, the agency that enforces our fish and wildlife laws is the Oregon State Police, Fish and Wildlife Division specifically. Lieutenant Dave Cleary is in the audience with us as a partner in that effort. Leadership. The commission is appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. There's a commissioner for each of the congressional districts, one from the east side, one from the west side. The governor appoints the chair of the commission as of a statutory change back in 2001. Up until that time, the chair of the commission was elected by the fellow commissioners. But today, the governor does appoint the chair of the commission. On page 4, please note the organizational chart, starting with the governor, which drops down to the Fish and Wildlife Commission, chaired by Marla Ray, and then to myself as the director of the agency, and then out to the two deputies, the regions, and the subsequent divisions. The agency has administratively assigned regions and watersheds throughout the state. There are 4 regions, and there are 10 watershed districts throughout the state where we implement programs under those divisions that I mentioned beforehand. On page 6, spend a little time on economic overview, I think. Oftentimes, fish and wildlife is looked upon as a recreational opportunity, a place for a way for people to spend their vacations, but underlying that, there is a lot of economy generated as a result of our fish and wildlife resources in this state. There are, in 2003, 295,422 hunters that were licensed in the state, 684,517 anglers licensed in the state of Oregon, 1,779 commercial fishing vessels licensed, 3,218 individuals licensed to fish commercially. Expenditures, personal income, and general revenues in Oregon, a total of $2 billion was spent on wildlife-related recreational activities in 2001. And that is a year that is most current with respect to those figures, as it comes from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service that does the national survey for us. There will be another posting of that coming out in 2006.
Yes, Representative Krieger.
Mr. Bowen? Just off the top here, what's all included in that survey? And I look at these jet boats being sold in Oregon at 30 to 40,000 a pop, hundreds of them. It seemed like that number would even be larger than what it is.
Chair Krupp, Representative Krieger, to get all the detail of what is included in that, I will need to turn to my economist who's back at the office and have him bring the detail sheets out. But to kind of give you a general idea, what is engaged in those figures can be factored into the gasoline that is purchased, the food that is purchased, the hunting equipment that is purchased, the boats that are purchased. By hunting equipment and angling equipment, I'm talking about fishing poles, rods and reels, rifles, shotguns, ammunition, and the ripple effect that has on the economy as it sifts down through the economic chain.
I'd like to see some of that. I don't know how detailed, but you know, if it wasn't for hunting and fishing, I wouldn't have a four-wheel drive pickup. Things of that nature. I wouldn't have an ATV.
all those type of things.
Yeah, and those things are all calculated into it. We'll make sure that the committee gets a detail sheet on that.
Okay, thank you. Okay,
thank you, Director. Please continue.
With respect to hunting in Oregon, in 2001, there was $481.8 million spent on hunting-related activities. As a result of that, $200.6 million was generated in personal income for Oregonians. In other words, that was money that was brought into the household. And as a result of that, $15.7 million was generated in general fund tax revenue. Now, please keep in mind that these are all one-year economic figures, not a biennial figure that like what our budget is figured on. For angling, in 2001, $733.4 million was spent. $298.7 million was generated in personal income for Oregonians, thereby generating $23.3 million of general fund tax revenues.
Now, Director Ball, the hunting, angling, wildlife viewing, each one of these components has a component of actual dollars that have been generated for the general fund, correct?
Chair Krupp, that is correct.
Okay, and just doing some simple math here, it looks like you're at, what, 37 or 47 million?
When
of general fund tax revenues generated by hunting, angling, and wildlife viewing?
Let's see. Yeah, I have 57, I think.
Okay, 57 then. So what percentage of that, or how much actual general fund revenue did your department get in 2001? I know that's a little bit of a loaded question because you're looking at a biennial expense of the 01-03 biennium. So you generated $57 million in 2001. How much general fund did you actually use to create that $57 million or help create it?
Chair Krupp, to my best recollection, looking back at 2001, I believe there was $21.5 million of general fund in the biennial budget of ODFW. I believe that is correct.
For the biennial budget, and that would, you just cut that in half, so that would be $10 million, just slightly over $10
million. Chair Krupp, that is correct.
Okay. So a $10 million investment returned $57 million to the general fund.
Chair Krupp, that is correct.
In 2001. Okay. I wanted to be clear on those numbers and dynamics there. Please continue.
And make sure that the committee understands as well, Chair Krupp, that general fund is a result of diminishing general fund resources has been cut considerably to this agency.
From the 2001 time frame, that is correct. And by the way, are you and we'll be going through your performance measures, but I'm assuming these 2001 numbers in reality today in the 2005 time frame that most of these numbers have increased in terms of the dollar values of them.
Chair Krupp, that would be my assumption. I would say particularly so in angling. It may be fairly stable in hunting.
In hunting.
Yes.
And one other quick question but before you move along is how come you don't have any more current information than 2001 for us?
Chair Krupp, members of the committee, the reason for that is we picked this information up from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, who does this national survey once every 5 years. We have one economist in our agency, and we simply don't have the manpower to generate those types of statistical figures on an annual basis.
Yes, Paul.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I just want to clarify for the 01-03 biennium, the actual expenditures of the general fund were $14.3 million. I believe the director's probably thinking about what he started the biennium with, and then through all the special sessions and fund shifts and reductions that went on, their actual expenditures were 14.3, so roughly $7 million a year.
$7 million a year returned $57 million to the general fund. Correct, Paul?
That would be the assumption based on what the information provided by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Okay. All right, very good. Please continue, Director Ball. Thanks.
With respect to wildlife viewing, $769 million was spent. $450 million of that was personal income, and that generated $18.2 million of general fund tax revenue.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Shoffler.
Well, every hunter and fisher wants to view their prey in their bag. Is that include the angling and the hunting, or that is separate, above and beyond what the numbers under hunting and angling are?
Chair Krupp, Representative Schaffler, that is separate from hunting and angling activities. Wildlife viewing pertains to people who would drive, for instance, to the Jewel Wildlife Area to view elk for a day, or that would stop at Dean's Creek and look at elk. People who drive to Bonneville to watch fish traverse the ladder. People who go out to Basket Slough just west of town to see the waterfowl on the refuge. Those kinds of things. People who just go birding to watch the eagles or songbirds. All those activities drive economic stimulus to the economy.
All right, please continue.
Commercial fishing, $82.3 million was received by commercial fishers for their harvests in 2003. $199 million was generated in personal income for Oregonians as a result of that economic engine. $84 million, I think this is something to note, $84 million in additional personal income was generated in Oregon by distant water fishers. As an example, fishermen who would leave Oregon to fish in Alaska and then return. Not only a product that might come back to Oregon, but the income as well. And then in return for that, a lot of times distant water fishermen will return to Oregon to refit his fishing vessel. And that provides quite a local economy in our coastal ports.
Director Ball, that actually begs a question, in that our distant water fishers, as we've seen the decline of our local fisheries on the Oregon coast to some extent over the last few years, has that fleet changed a lot in terms of its makeup? Is it static? I know that there are less boats that are engaging in offshore fishing as a whole, but has that fleet moved to other distant waters, or is this kind of a new phenomenon, or is this a kind of a static level that we've even kind of count on from year to year?
Chair Krupp, members of the committee, the fishing industry in Oregon has changed. Most of that has changed as a result of cutbacks in allocation on ground fish. Commercial boats that were typically engaged in what they call a trawl fishery, which is a towing of a net for those bottom fish, those species have declined off the Oregon coast. Certain species have declined considerably, and as a result of that, the Pacific Fisheries Management Council, through NOAA Fisheries, has restricted harvest on certain species of fish off our coast. Now, it has also done something else. It has also driven Oregon fishermen to capitalize on other fishery resources that we have. Currently, as an example, the crab fishery in Oregon has been exceptional the last 2 years, and there have been people who have moved from other fisheries to focus on crab. You're seeing, last year and this year, you're seeing record numbers of Dungeness crab being harvested in Oregon waters. There have also been people who have ventured out to look at fisheries in Alaska, off the coast of Canada, and elsewhere as well. And that all generates income back to Oregon for those Oregon residents. In this last year, we've also seen a buyout program sponsored by the U.S. By NOAA Fisheries to reduce the number of fishing vessels off our coast. So, yes, things have changed in the commercial industry.
Yes, Representative Krieger.
What you're referring to, Mr. Ball's effort shift, because we open and close and have limits and trip limits and these type of things where you can't make a living anymore in one fishery, so you have to take part. So we have, I think we have more boats taking part in multiple fisheries than we did 20 years ago, for instance, because you used to have just a dragger, a guy that fished salmon and crab. Now he has to hit three or four fisheries, maybe a live fishery on the beach, but in an effort to properly manage some of those limited resources, we've actually caused an impact in, I believe, in some other fisheries that, you know, we should have known was going to happen, and then we see the effect of it, and then we got to manage because we caused a greater shift, for instance, into shrimp or into crab. Just maybe a comment, I guess.
Chair Krupp, Representative Krieger, I agree with you in your assessment of that. Participants in the fishery have moved into other areas and other fisheries, and it's very common to see a boat engaged in two and three different fishing activities off our coast. Of course, as I said, the last 2 years, crab has been a tremendous push economically for commercial fishermen. In fact, the crab fishery generates more money, more income, more money than the other fisheries combined at this time. Now, that could change. Crab fishery is rather cyclical, and so you can see a downturn in those harvest rates here in the next couple of years, too. I don't anticipate sustaining the harvest rates we're experiencing today.
And why is that?
That's just how the crab works.
Okay.
That's a scientific answer for you.
For me.
If you take a look back in time, some people look at crab as a decadal cyclic nature. You'll see rise and falls in that population over that 10-year period. Here about 2 to 3 and 4 years ago, there were some researchers that were involved in research out in the ocean, not specific to crab, but for other species that would pick up a lot of spawn, crab spawn, in their seining nets that they were conducting research for. And there was exceptional spawning success in the crab species off our coast. And you're now starting to see those crabs that were larvae at that time and then settled out now to be full-grown crab. So I think all that has something to do with it. Ocean conditions, food, nutrient that's available for crab, everything came together for them.
Well, very good, and we are glad that they are doing as well as they are. Please continue. Thank you.
The next section that I'd like to present to the committee is performance measures. There are 7 performance measures that are tracked by the agency with respect to 4 benchmarks specific. The first performance measure is the percent of the licensed flying population with hunting licenses and or tags. You'll see that on the graph there has been a reduction in the number of people who have purchased licenses and tags for hunting. Below our benchmark figure or percentage limit, we've seen that general decrease in hunting activities throughout the United States. It's not something that is unique to us, but in general, hunting activities and hunting license sales have decreased across the U.S. And that is also, I might mention to everyone, that is a subset measurement of people between the years, ages of 12 and 69. Those are the ages that when a license is required at 12 to hunt big game, and then a free license is awarded after the age of 69. So that subset of people are the numbers of folks that we can track accurately that are hunting.
Senator Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What's the success ratios in this group now? I mean, I sort of anecdotally, that's harder to fill your deer tag or your elk tag. It's getting fewer people hunting. Population of states growing, so we understand why that ratio has changed. But what's the success rate for people like now? Has that changed dramatically?
I would say, Chair Krupp, Senator Bates, I would not say that the success has changed appreciably. It rises and falls on an annual basis, depending upon the availability of animals to harvest. And for instance, let's give an example. We have seen declines in mule deer hunting activity over the last 20 years. But we've also reduced the amount of opportunity to hunt mule deer. As we reduce the opportunity to hunt mule deer, we keep the numbers of hunters down, but their success rate has been fairly static. Now, like I said, it bumps around a little bit from year to year. But since we've reduced that opportunity, the percentage within the hunting participants remains fairly consistent. So it had that the success rate per person hasn't changed, but opportunity has changed. And I think there's an important difference to look at there. If you looked at percentage success, which is a measurement, I don't want to take that away from it, but it doesn't tell the whole story, because there are fewer people being allowed to hunt mule deer today than what they had in past years. Many of us who are 50 years or older think back 30 years ago and remember quite a different hunting scenario for mule deer in the state of Oregon than what they've experienced today. And that's attributed to a change in the number of animals available for harvest. Now, one of the things, too, that we're looking at is the changing habitat, particularly on the west side of the Cascade Mountains in western Oregon for black-tailed deer. We've seen deer numbers starting to decline as a result of what we feel is a shift in habitat availability, premium habitat available for blacktail in western Oregon. And a lot of that, we feel, is a result of reduced logging on public lands as well as on private lands over what we've seen in past years. Deer are a successional animal, and that ecosystem needs to be set back so that they have vegetation that's conducive to their needs. And a mature forest doesn't avail itself to good deer production. So it has changed in the state over time as well.
Mr. Chair,
the fact that Oregon has a huge amount of public lands, about 60% of the state lands, that has a huge effect upon your gaming population. That's for some species. That'd be a fair statement.
Chair Krieger, Senator Nelson, yes, I would say that is a fair assumption.
Just maybe we need another spotted owl in the form of a blacktail deer or something.
Well, Chair Krieger, Senator Nelson, one of the things that we did this last fall was that we met with the regional forester of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife, or of the U.S. Forest Service, and one of the things that we talked about was asking that they consider hunting as an element of consideration when they look at timber harvest. It is an important aspect for many people in the state of Oregon that utilize our federal lands that are under forest. And they were encouraged by that. They certainly took note of it. And here about 3 weeks ago, we held a symposium down at Oregon State University where about 350, 400 people came to listen to what has happened on the landscape by land managers that has changed the habitat in relation to our large ungulates, deer and elk that are on the landscape. And so I think it's getting the attention of more and more people. But it's not something that's done locally. It's something across the landscape that has changed.
Yes.
So if I got this right, that if the black tail gets listed, we have to log more.
Nothing wrong with that in my book, but perhaps the director shouldn't respond to that. the Department of Forestry will have a crack at them later.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right, let's please. I did want to, at some point though, when we get into talking about the Wolf Plan, I would like to get some sense of you if there is you anticipate any certain impact on hunting success or opportunity. Because if there's any significant impact upon those populations, then I think it would diminish. So, and I don't know whether you want to address that now or later is fine, but it is something that I'd like to explore.
Chair Krupp, it's whatever your pleasure is. We can step into the wolf discussion now, or we can postpone that till later.
Well, why don't we postpone that to a little bit later and kind of move forward with performance measures? I want to stay focused on that for the moment. Again, to reiterate here on performance measure number one is that the population, the numbers of people as a percentage of our state population of hunters between 12 and 69 has actually diminished a bit. But that isn't necessarily an indication that less people are out there hunting, but rather that the population of the state has grown, and less of those people in the population increase are hunting, correct?
Chair Krupp, your observation is correct, and use this as an example. We saw quite a population growth in the state of Oregon from the early to late 90s, but we did not see an increase in the number of license sales in this agency, which led us to believe that most of the people who moved to Oregon to seek employment in high-tech industries did not particularly pursue hunting and fishing as an activity.
Okay. And so have the actual fishing and hunting tag sales remained pretty static?
Chair Krupp, in the last few years, they have remained static. We have seen a slight decline over the last 20 years, but they have been somewhat stable.
Okay, very good. Please continue.
One of the things that we also pursue in the hunting arena is that we provide hunter education to Oregon citizens, and that we train approximately 8,000 hunters per year, and that is primarily accomplished by the use of volunteers. You're going to hear a little bit more about volunteers as we move through our presentation today. This agency receives a tremendous benefit from our volunteers, people who want to assist the department in the programs. It makes a big difference. Creates a savings to the people of Oregon and to this agency. And one of the things that we've also noted, and I bring to everyone's attention, and it's come out several times. In fact, it came out with one of the committee members when we were visiting with him earlier this session. The number one reason that people explain to us as to why they dropped out of hunting or fishing is that they don't have time. And across the U.S., that's the number one explanation as to why they don't hunt or fish anymore. And it seems like more people who hunt drop out because of lack of time than people who drop out of fishing. So it's something that I think we've experienced across the U.S. There's just not enough time for that activity in our lives today compared to what it was 20 and 30 years ago.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Dinkelder.
Thank you. This is sort of a follow-up question, Lindsay, and I've heard this, but I don't see the statistics here because you only showed us for 1 year. I've heard that there's been a huge growth, however, in wildlife viewing. arena as far as you know, demand for that. And you know, I don't know if that's just in specific areas of the state, or are you seeing that with newer folks moving in, or have you seen an increase in sales? Or you know, I certainly hear it in the Portland metro area that there's a greater demand on some of the facilities that are there. Savvy's Island is an example, and some of the other areas.
Chair Krupp, Representative Dingfelder, there are more people who do engage in wildlife viewing activities. That is true. That has increased as a result of Oregon's population increasing too. Savvy Island is a unique area. It's a wildlife area, 13,000 acres of state-owned property on the island, next to a major city. That metropolitan population center goes to Savvy Island for recreational activities, birding, fishing, hunting. So Savvy Island, as you pointed out, is a very unique wildlife area for us, and lots of people go there. That's truly a gem when you take a look at other states around the U.S. I don't know of another state, in talking with other directors, who are able to have a wildlife area such as we have at Savvy Island near a large metropolitan area like Portland. It is a very unique situation for Oregon.
And just to
yes, please.
Since you said that the information that you receive from U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is just done once every 5 years, so we won't get any more information until 2006. Do you have information? Can you show us sort of what the trends have been over the last 10 years? It's just something I'd be curious to see, because in here I think it was just the numbers were just listed for that one year, 2001. Is that correct?
I've got some information here.
You can give it to me afterwards if you want. I'm just curious to see what the trend is.
I'll tell you what we'll do. I'll get a good copy to all of the committee members. We'll try to have that together for you by tomorrow, prior to the hearing.
Okay?
Senator Bates.
I'm going to go back to my question about the quality of hunting, but not this time on hunting, but on fishing. And it's something you probably can't answer for me right now, but I'll tell you kind of where I'm coming from and ask you to get some information if you could. Those of us who fish a lot, and some of us don't have time because we got married, you know. It's a whole different problem.
Whoa. You're on record.
I'm not testing that one.
I'm trying to get a wedge for me at home, okay? So I'm working on this. Anyway, seriously, the quality of the fishery in Oregon for many people has been in decline for the last 10 or 15 years. Many people feel that, with the exception of our salmon stocks improving, the remainder of our quality fishing in the state is going in the wrong direction. Many people are going out of state to fish now. I have people in southern Oregon that don't buy licenses in Oregon. They buy them in California because the fishery is managed apparently differently there. Managed for larger fish, fewer fish, catch and release, a higher quality of fishing experience. I like to have an idea of what's happening in states like Montana, Idaho, and California as far as out-of-state people coming in to fish in those areas. That's a major industry for those states, and they've very nicely exploited their natural resources. It's expensive to go there. People go there to fish. And I don't hear that much from Oregon. I think we've got a resource here we're not really touching the way we should. And I'm very concerned about how we're managing that fishery, whether we're having enough quality fishing going on. Even our hatchery programs are geared primarily to, as an example, to 8 to 9 inch trout. And when I've never heard anybody complain about how big a fish they caught. I've had them complain about catching a lot of little hatchery fish. And it's very anecdotal. The loss of Diamond Lake and other areas in our state have really made a big difference in our fisheries. And I don't know if you can get any figures on that, and maybe the other states won't tell you. But I'd be very interested to see if we're seeing people go not to Oregon for the recreation for the week of fishing every year, but they go to Montana or Wyoming or Idaho or even Northern California instead of coming here to Oregon. Because I know it's going in the other direction pretty rapidly for the people I talk to, but it's very anecdotal. I'd like to see what you guys think as far as what's really happening.
Chair Krupp, Senator Bates. Let's reflect back on a couple things. We have some of our near record salmon and steelhead runs the last 5 years.
Yeah, I say with the exception of those.
And That having been said, let's recognize, as long as we're going to be talking about what tourism is to Oregon, let's recognize that there are a tremendous number of people who participate in the ocean salmon fisheries, our Columbia River salmon fisheries, as well as our Willamette salmon fisheries, fall Chinook on the coast as well, and then winter steelhead. Summer steelhead in various places along our coast, a lot of the summer steelhead in places like the John Day, Grand Drawn Snake, and Deschutes River. Trout fisheries, when you move into trout fisheries, I think you've seen a rebound of coastal cutthroat in many locations, which in many people's minds is a trophy sport fish. The red band trout, rainbow trout of central and eastern Oregon, the Lahontan cutthroat, are all species that are pursued. The Deschutes River, as I mentioned earlier, is a big draw for a trophy class fishery. Now, there have been some things changed in your lakes and reservoirs, particularly in areas like Central Oregon, where you had fisheries at Diamond Lake, Crane Prairie, and Wickiup, which have all been impacted by introduction of a bass and also other bait-type fish that are exotic species to that system. And so your trout fishery in some of those premier waters has changed. I would not even hint that it hasn't changed. So there are people who fish those lakes for 30 years that do not catch fish there like they used to. And Diamond Lake is lost at this point as a trout fishery. And there again, probably the best example of a trout fishery gone south is Diamond Lake, that has affected more people than I can imagine. When we've been in our town hall meetings, when we've been on tour with the commission, there isn't a day that goes by where people do not mention the fact that Diamond Lake is not what it was when they were a child or a young adult with a young family, and please bring it back. That's what we hear. And so I'm not surprised that you as legislators are hearing the same thing about some of our trout fisheries, because they have changed. But then again, I also think we need to recognize what Oregon does have to offer. And we do have some strong trout fisheries throughout the state. And we do have some of the best salmon and steelhead fishing on record. Quite frankly, I kind of wonder why people travel outside Oregon to go salmon fishing because it's been that good in recent times.
Senator? Okay, good enough.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Schaffer.
Please. I don't do much bank fishing anymore. Since I was a kid, I did a lot of it. But I've fished off a lot of charters and a lot of fishermen in several states and a couple countries. And I got to say, I've had great luck in Oregon. Now, it is salmon I'm talking about. So,
no question.
And even the attitude of the people that I've been fishing with is different here compared to... I don't care if I ever go out on a charter out of San Diego again. The way they do business down there, I don't like. I'd go out anywhere in the Oregon coast over that place any day of the week. It's just the attitude more than anything. But I just have to throw that in there. Thank you.
Okay. Members, I've had Paul print out for you a little different, the progress report on the performance measures. And this one includes... the targets and the data from the agency, and that is how it is different from what is currently in your binder. And I thought this would be instructive because, me being curious as I am, I actually have some questions about that, and we'll get into that. Director Ball, between 2005 and 2006, you're showing a substantial decrease in the percentage of license-buying population with hunting licenses and or tags. And your numbers from 2000 on have been pretty static, frankly. They've not moved marginally, you know, 0.1, 0.2, that type of thing. Why that whole percentage point drop between 2005 and 2006?
Chair Krupp, members of the committee, what we're looking at is a gradual decline in the number of people who are purchasing licenses, and we just adjust, that is a forecasted adjustment to our baseline.
So basically you think that your target has been a little bit high and that you need to make this adjustment now rather than an incremental adjustment downward. You're just going to kind of bite the bullet and do it all right now and get down to 11% and use that as your target then.
That's correct, Chair Krupp.
I'm just curious, though. You've since 2000, you've stayed above, well, even to 2005. You've gone from 11.4 clear up to 12%. In terms of a target, you've not been able to make that target. So, in fact, you can see the numbers have been declining from 99 on down, 11.8, 11.4, 10.9, 10.6, 10.3. How far down do you see this drop continuing in terms of a forecast?
Chair Krupp, members of the committee, I'm not able to tell you where this is going to end up at.
Fair enough.
It's a little too early to tell. The dynamics associated with hunting may change. That is how we see that trend starting to develop, and so that was a forecast that we made.
Okay. Please continue. Thanks.
The next performance measure is the percent of license buying population with respect to angling licenses and tags. One of the things that's interesting to note, we saw an increase in angling license sales in 2001. It's dropped off slightly since that time. I think a lot of that is directly attributed to the tourism trade and abundant salmon and steelhead population. Some people reflect on that and mention that there could be an interest of people changing from a national origin, a near national origin, to more of a local tourism trade as a result of 9/11. I can't say with certainty that that's the cause, but I can say there's a correlation. 9/11 occurred. We had extremely abundant salmon and steelhead populations at that time, continue to this day, but there has been a slight drop in angling license sales. Still above our projections, a slight amount, but there has been a slight decrease. We continue to offer activities associated with hunting, with angling, like free fishing weekend, angler education programs, and also the Youth Angling Enhancement Program, which this legislature approved last session to allow us to purchase trout specific for youth angling events around the state, which has been a good program, I think, and one I hope that we can continue. Third measurement is the number of wildlife damage complaints received annually per FTE. It shows a dramatic decrease in complaints per FTE in 2003 as compared to the previous years. A lot of that is a result of our wildlife division looking at...
Senator Bates, please.
I want to bang away on this a little bit longer if I can, this old drum here, for a moment, if you indulge me. You purchase hatchery fish for kids in angling. Tell me about that program real quick.
Okay. Chair Krupp, Senator Bates, what we did last session was we felt that if we could create an opportunity to provide children, we're talking about basically kids under 18 years of age, an opportunity to go fishing, that number one, it may engage them in another outdoor activity, which I and many other people see as being very healthy. And it also creates the opportunity to introduce them into the sport of fishing. And so what we did was we allocated $50,000 of license and tag money to be matched with money from the Oregon Wildlife Heritage Foundation, donated money. And so the Oregon Wildlife Heritage Foundation did an outstanding job at contacting people around the state to create a donation account for youth fishing opportunities. So we took our state dollars and we doubled them. And then, in a way that helps also many of our small business owners who have aquacultures, we directed those fisheries to purchase trout from the local private aquaculturalists. Those people planted those fish in the small ponds and lakes and reservoirs. We announced it over the media, radio and print media locally and statewide, that there would be a youth angling event at a location, and then the kids came and they went fishing. One of the things that really surprised us that we looked at, we thought it would be like a 1 or 2 day event where we would have lots of people, but in those locations where we had those youth angling opportunities, we found kids coming back. And so if they had free time, told a story to us that they were going fishing. That's not bad.
Senator?
What I'm really trying to get to here is that I think the key thing driving this is the quality of this experience when someone goes out and goes fishing, and we really haven't answered that or had a direct answer from this. And, you know, I have my own personal experiences of leaving the state and going fishing other places. It's the thing I like to do the most in my off time. And I hear the same complaints pretty routinely in the lack of quality of fishing in Oregon. That's what I'm trying to get to in a very nice way here. You don't have a whole lot of control to a certain degree of what happens out in the ocean as far as salmon, stillet, and thankas. We're having great runs right now. But I'm afraid if you subtracted the effect of these great runs we're having, which may not continue, which I hope they do, may not continue, I wonder where we really be as far as having people fishing in this state, from out of state and in the state itself. So my only point I'm trying to make, and I'll stop beating the drum now, and I'd like to see is open up the quality of that fishing. Think about things we can do to make the quality a better experience. Catch and release, larger fish being stocked, going to private hatcheries and buying more fish if we want to, as far as a quality fishery is concerned. I think the program you just outlined is exactly what you should be doing. You have a free fishing weekend every year, I'm aware of, too, and that's great. I think you have to build into that the quality of the product you're offering to the public. You're competing with home video games and a bunch of other stuff that kids don't think about going out anymore. And I think it's something we're losing in our society. It's really important. So I'm just sort of exhorting you to think about what are these other states doing to get a better quality fishing, not just in salmon and steelhead in our run endemic runs, but in the fishing we do in our backyards all the time. And that's all I'm asking for here. Thank you.
Well, Senator, I appreciate where you're trying to go. And so Lindsay, I mean, what methodologies can you employ? I mean, you just mentioned one, and Senator Bates has alluded to several others. Is this a direction that you're concerned about as an agency in terms of the quality of the fishing experience, and what are you doing to address that?
Chair Krupp, Senator Bates, a quality fishing experience is a different experience for a lot of people as one might suspect. What Senator Bates, I think, is referring to is the size of the fish. Is that kind of where you're coming from?
Size, catch ratios, how often you can go out and get something and how often you can't. You already mentioned some of our prime waters have been lost, not through anything you have done as far as management or not. I mean, things that tuna chubs replaced and bass and perch and other things. But the loss of those kind of fisheries is really important. And I think it's affected those areas where it's happened pretty heavily as far as tourism is concerned. And all I'm saying is other states have gotten together with and set up Blue Ribbon Waters. They really go after these fishermen who will come in and spend substantial amount of money for a week of fishing. But they're looking for a quality experience, which isn't always available in Oregon except in very limited areas. You know, talking about the Umpqua, we're talking about the Deschutes. a couple other places, and then it gets pretty thin after that sometimes.
Chair Krupp, Senator Bates, are you focusing on a trout fishery per se? Is that
clearly? I'm focusing on a trout fishery.
So
I don't want to take a lot of committee time, or we can discuss it later. But I mean, there's a different sense in Oregon than other states sometimes.
So your attention would be drawn towards a trophy trout fishery
as part of your plans.
So that the Chair Krupp and Senator Bates, so you do know, we do stock trophy trout to a certain percentage level in many of our waters. One has to also appreciate the longer you hold those trout, the more money that they do cost. And so that's a factor that we have to look at as well. It's a lot cheaper if we can raise trout in a way that they feed themselves and grow themselves.
I understand the argument for wild trout, too, so we could be here all day talking about this and the rest of the week. I just wanted to make my point. I feel I've done that. Let's move on. Okay.
Chair Krupp, Senator Bates, the point is made. Maybe with your assistance, we can take a look at a performance measure that deals directly with a quality trout fishery, something of that nature.
I'm going to look at that later with you.
I would certainly entertain that discussion and take a look at that. I have no problem whatsoever.
Thank you.
Okay, so noted. I will write that down. And just for the edification of the members, the co-chairs have some additional performance measures that they'd like the agency to consider. And they're certainly open to any additional ones that we might so design. And that is part of our purpose here, too, in discussing performance measures is to let our concerns be known and let the agency take note of that and work with them to develop those performance measures that not only mean something to us as managers of this department, but also clearly to the people that we serve, the customers ultimately, which are the same customers that ODFW has. So I'm going to make note of that. And Director Ball, why don't you move on? Thank you.
Natural fish populations monitored per FTE. You'll notice from our baseline, we have decreased in numbers of the native fish populations that were monitored.
Hatchery before fish. We go any further on that, yes, Senator, go ahead.
This draws on my attention. We're talking about the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board and the Bonneville Power Administration applying funds. Someplace here I was looking at the governor's recommended budget this year is from Bonneville Power is about $22 million. Is that that's what the governor's recommending?
Chair Krupp, Senator Nelson, I'd have to look at the figure. I think I'm sure it's right.
It's in this book. I was just looking at on page 26. I don't know. We have some issues, I guess, in our part of the country that, where a lot of the ratepayers are paying monies into Bonneville Power Administration. That money is transferred to you in some manner, shape, or form. Our people are having some problems. They just don't feel like there's any accounting. I mean, where is that money going to? And the thing that really brought this up is that there's been some lawsuits filed against Summer Spill, and our people are feeling, well, they're using their own money to be sued with. So they have a real problem with that. So is there any way you can give us any accounting or any way of showing us where that money from BPA is going to be spent? Is it just going all for monitoring fish, or are we sending some to help with the lawsuits? Or do you guys even send money to the AG's office to help with these lawsuits?
Chair Krupp, Senator Nelson, help me sort through some of the questions. There were two or three questions there. Make sure I cover them all. First question with respect to lawsuits. And I suspect you're referring to lawsuits that are by the state of Oregon.
Right, yes.
And whether we are an amicus or a full-fledged litigant or whatever, where does that money come from? typically what will happen is that the agency that has the purview of where the lawsuit sits statutorily will pay for those legal services by the Oregon Department of Justice. In some instances, the governor's office will bill multiple state agencies across the board for those funds to pay for Department of Justice services. It can come from different funding sources from state coffers. Now, I can't recall when BPA money had been used for a lawsuit. In fact, I really doubt that because BPA money is awarded to the state through a grant process by project, as I recall. I can't think in my mind that BPA money was used in that way. I think it's prohibited by the grant itself. But the granting process for BPA money is probably, in my estimation, one of the more strenuous, creates one of the more strenuous reviews of any public institution with respect to delivery of dollars. And I'll just kind of briefly explain the process and how that works. The states, the four states and tribal governments in the Pacific Northwest deliver, first of all, come forth with their proposals internally, where there's an internal review of all the states and tribes and other federal agencies involved in the Pacific Northwest with respect to salmon on the Columbia River. They then hand those proposals off to the Columbia Basin Fish and Wildlife Authority, which is made up of all the federal agencies and tribes and states, and they debate the merits of those grant requests at that level. It comes out of the Columbia Basin Fish and Wildlife Authority, and then it moves to the Northwest Power and Conservation Council staff. And the staff of that council then reviews all of the grant requests that come in. At that point, and once that review is done, they then hand that off to the Power Planning Council for a vote. And the council votes as to which project should be funded. They then hand all those projects off to the BPA, Bonneville Power Administration, and then Bonneville Power Administration has the final say as to what is funded or is not funded. And then, we're not done yet, and then this committee and the Legislative Assembly gives me the spending authority, spending limitation for the federal BPA dollars. Now, that's quite a journey for the money.
This policy, basically, of Oregon joining as a friend of the court, how far back does that go? Do you know what's the underlying reason for that? I mean, because that causes us just great grief out in my part of the country when all of a sudden we see the state of Oregon basically raising our cost of doing business and filing a lawsuit in support of it. It just really gets to us.
Chair Krupp, Senator Nelson, going back, I can't. There have been a number of lawsuits on Columbia River fish management, not all of which have been where the state of Oregon has been a participant. We've been sued by different groups on the Columbia River management. We've been in amicus. And most recently, that's the point that then Governor Kitzhaber took with respect to Columbia River management on the summer spill, which came to everyone's attention about a year ago and through the summer. Up to including Governor Kulongoski making the statement in his State of the State and subsequent conversations too, that he would be willing to be a plaintiff in management of the Columbia River through its current biological opinion. from NOAA Fisheries. Policy positions that have been taken by the governor's office on that issue have driven us to those points. And I think that's where we are today.
It's not a follow-up. I mean, that's the thing that seems to be the word crossroads here, is that we're talking about improving the Oregon's economy. What part does division play? I know you have a mission that you only worry about fish, but I mean, it's a bigger spectrum than that, and it seems like, well, first hand you say, well, we want more economic development, and then they says, well, we're going to sue and to prevent that economic development. I mean, that's the thing, that's the real issue that I see from, at least coming from my constituents, is there has to be more transparency. Which direction, where is the Division of Fish and Wildlife going? How are they spending their money? Where are they getting their money from? We're just all concerned about, you know, what's being right and what's being wrong.
Chair Krupp, Senator Nelson, you want to know where we spend our money?
I mean, we know, but I mean, it's a very complicated process that you went through doing that. But I mean, part of that money is going to finance lawsuits, which seems to be counterintuitive to the fact that we're trying to promote economic development. So, and you know, the policy seems like you're conflicted here within the agency. You know, we're trying to go one direction, help fund our education and all those things. And on the other hand, we're filing lawsuits to really prevent that. So what I'm trying to get to is, you know, how do you guys? How do you spend your money? I mean, if it's you have a great amount of federal funds, a great amount of other funds, and what they're trying, what my constituents are basically asking is to find out is, you know, how do you spend your money? I guess that is the bottom line. How do you spend your money?
Chair Krupp, Senator Nelson, you're on the right committee.
Yeah, that's it.
Number one, I want to make sure that you understand. I cannot think of a time when BPA money, which is, quote, the ratepayer money that you're talking about, was used to fund a lawsuit. As I mentioned, those dollars are grant-specific, to my best recollection. And I can show you what BPA money funds. Now, some of the money that you've noted in your packet is pass-through money of that BPA money that goes from BPA to us and then goes out. Some of it is specific to the grants. And I can get you copies of a report that I did for some of the electric utilities and co-ops that specifically outlines the process. There's a one-page summary of the projects and grants. And then there's 8 or 9 pages behind that to give a brief description of the BPA expenditure.
I'd appreciate something like that.
Could you provide that for the committee, Director Paul?
We can have that for you first thing tomorrow.
Okay.
That'd be great. And if you, Senator Nelson, if you have additional questions on this, why don't we talk about them tomorrow? I'd like to remain focused on moving forward on the performance measures here, but do provide us with that report, because this is an issue that has been expressed to a number of the committee members, and it'd be good if we could have that report tomorrow and we could talk about that. Yes, Representative Shaw.
Just very briefly, the senator is not alone in his concerns on these issues, just for the record.
Chair Krupp, Representative Schaffler, I've been contacted by a number of people who have concerns about the policy position that's been taken by the governor. The governor is very sincere in his endeavors to recover fish in the Columbia River. He thinks that is a position that the people of Oregon would expect him to take. And I also feel that the governor is trying to look for that balance, too, as to where you weigh the economic and the natural resource base.
Representative?
Just so I can clarify, I think we're all looking for that balance, but I want to clarify what I meant to say. The senator's not alone on this committee with his concerns. I share some of his concerns as well. Thank you.
Yes, Senator.
I need to talk to one of your biologists about this, but I've had somebody tell me actually the health of the river is what we're talking about. It's really not determined by salmon, which is migratory, that goes through it, is actually determined by year-round residents, which would be like smallmouth bass, largemouth bass, walleye trout, something like that. Could one of your staff give me some information as to whether that's what somebody has told me? Is that true or is that not true?
Chair Krupp, Senator Nelson, I think there are several ways to look at the health of a stream. Resident fish that stay in the stream year-round is certainly one of those tools that a person has, because what lives in the water is an indicator species of what condition the stream is in. And there are different species that have a greater tolerance for different water conditions. If you're just talking about water quality, that wildlife is a good indicator as to what's going on in a system.
I guess it's just a follow-up, but what I've been told is that if you have a large population of smallmouth bass, that's very good. That shows an overall. If you have a large population of largemouth bass, which I don't know the difference is, then that shows that basically your stream is becoming unhealthy. And I'd just like something from someone, your biologist or something, to either confirm that or keep me on the right track here.
I don't know. I'm not familiar with that correlation of bad to good water conditions with those two species of fish. They inhabit different types of water. We can certainly get in touch with you and discuss it.
I'd appreciate that.
Okay? Yeah. We'll do that.
Okay, very good. Please continue.
Hatchery fish populations monitored annually per FTE. You see a slight decrease in the numbers of populations monitored there as well from our baseline.
Before you go any further, let's go back to number three, because I wanted to ask a question about that. The correlation here is that if your individual FTE are actually paying more or actually responding to more complaints, that is good.
Now, are you talking about wildlife damage complaints?
Performance here? Number three, yes. Okay. Performance measure number three. So if they're responding to more of those complaints, if each employee is responding to more, that means that you're being more efficient in terms of the utilization of your personnel, correct?
With the looking at this measurement, the fewer complaints there are per FTE is looked upon as a significant change to the benefit of Oregonians. In other words, what is it we're doing that reduces the numbers of complaints in our management programs, complaints that plague private landowners?
Okay.
And a reduction of those complaints is viewed as a good trend in our efforts.
Okay, so is a better one of the things that concerns us is what is the outcome of the responses to these complaints. While this is a good measure in terms of the efficiency of your staff being able to handle complaints and also at the same time your policies of reducing complaints, wouldn't another measure be that would be reasonable here is what is the outcome, the solutions that were created? How did you answer the complaints, and what were the outcomes of that? That would be, I think, an important measure for us to be able to gauge your effectiveness in serving those people.
Chair Krupp, as a suggestion, was the citizen satisfied?
Precisely.
Was his complaint responded to, and did he receive
satisfactorily?
Service?
Right. That I would encourage you to take a look at adding that as a performance measure along with this also, because that also helps us understand and measure how you're satisfying the people that we all serve. Please continue to number four.
Natural fish populations monitored annually per FTE. You'll see a slight decline in the number monitored per FTE in this performance measure. as you will, in the number of hatchery fish populations monitored per FTE. Wildlife species monitored, you'll see a slight decline in 2003 as well. Moving on to the seventh performance measure, number of unscreened priority water diversions. We have set up a tracking of the unscreened diversions that are in Oregon. And as the years go by, we continue to add more screening devices on those diversions. And we have a downward trend in the number of unscreened diversions in the state. Hopefully, we'll have screens on all diversions before it's over.
Well, they prioritized as far as the ones that are causing, you think, the greatest effect on loss of fish?
Chair Krieger, members of the committee, that is correct. It's a prioritized list based on the resource need. That concludes our performance measures.
I was out of the room for a minute. I don't know if it'd be appropriate, but I'll wait until we get to the budget. I'll do it. We'll get the budget presentation.
Mr. Siever. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I just wanted to make a few comments on the record from some input that the co-chairs had when they were reviewing these performance measures. And number one is that there was some concern about measures 3, 4, 5, and 6 and that they were efficiency measures and really are supposed to measure the efficiency of what's being done. In other words, you would normally see targets that would be going up. I've talked to the agency about these. Well, I think we'll be working on some different versions of these, so you'll probably be seeing those in the future. Also wanted to let you know that they had some suggestions for some additional measures, and I thought I'd just go over those briefly so that you would be up to speed of what they were kind of thinking. And one of those was some type of measure of how some of the fisheries are doing, if they're increasing or stable. And we've talked to the department about that. They'll be looking through what data they have available so that they can, we don't want to create a lot of extra work or expense, but I think we'll be looking to try to develop some type of measure of, you know, the outcome of how the fisheries are doing. Another area they were interested in is, and while this department doesn't directly enforce angling and hunting regulations, they certainly do fund a large portion of the budget of the agency that does. And so they were interested in having both agencies, the Department of Fish and Wildlife and Oregon State Police, measure the rate of compliance with hunting regulations and laws among hunters checked, and also the rate of compliance with fishing regulations and laws among anglers checked. I believe OSP has a measure for angling, but it's specific to salmonids, and I think that they were more interested in all fish that were checked.
Okay.
Chair, can I just follow up on that? Thank you, Paul, because that was a question I had is, in some of these measures, well, one question was, and I've asked this before, is how these link to the Oregon plan, you know, as we're talking about recovering populations and especially looking at not just monitoring fish, but what does it mean for recovering, you know, runs in the state. And I don't know if that's, trying to think back when we were talking with OWEB about some of their performance measures. And again, maybe, Paul, I can ask you to help me in maybe even just giving us a sheet of all the performance measures that link to the Oregon plan. I mean, it would be helpful to have that in one place because I have to go back to each agency and look and say, you know, where is it? How do we connect the dots among the different agencies that are working on the Oregon plan? So I don't know if there's any effort to coordinate those performance measures. Second question I had is in regards to screening. I mean, that I know that we're using, I think, Measure 66 money towards that, so there's some connection there with the Oregon plan, but I guess seeing what does this mean as far as the number of miles of habitat that we're opening up. And I don't know if we should set performance measures or goals for looking at the number of miles that we're opening up, because part of why we're screening, if I'm correct on this, Lindsay, and correct me if I'm not, is to try to either prevent, you know, fatalities with fish or make sure that we're opening up well, actually that's more looking at culverts, but opening up areas that have not been accessible to runs before. And it would be helpful to have a performance measure looking at culvert replacement. And again, I know that's connected to forestry and lots of other agencies are doing it, but why are we pushing on culverts so much? My understanding is to try to open up more habitat. So those are a couple of things that I was just thinking about. And I don't know if you want to address those, Lindsay, or we can talk later, or Paul, if those have come up in discussion. But again, some type of connection with the Oregon plan would be helpful when looking at performance of these budgets.
I'm not certain. What? Can you get together with Lindsay and talk with him about that? Mr. Ballin, reference to Mr. Sieberts. Paul, you were talking about measuring success based on success of the fishery.
I think that there was one that was measure. Talking about how the fishery stocks are doing. The other one was compliance. A couple compliance measures
specifically to the stocks. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got so many variables with ocean conditions, predators, weather, water. I don't know if you could ever develop one that would really tell you what was causing the effect. Am I looking at that right? Or I mean, you could have a guess, and you might be over a long trend, you might see something, but boy, trying to do it, you know, from year to year, I don't know how you do that. You don't know, for instance, this year we're going into a drought. You may have a huge number of fish coming back, but maybe not water conditions for them to be so successful had you had a wet year. And so you'd have to have in your performance measure all these variable conditions that you took into consideration.
Chair Krieger, members of the committee, you are correct. There are very, very many variables that affect a wild population of fish or big game or any other species of wildlife. Sometimes the outside world is pretty harsh. And it deals different factors that a fish and wildlife species isn't able to compete with, and they succumb to that. So you have to look at those variables. With respect to performance measures for this agency, I'll share a bit of frustration with the committee. I want to measure performance of this agency worse than anybody else. That's how I measure how well we do, and I want this agency to be very successful. The performance measures we have today were brought forth in 2001, reviewed in 2002, adopted by a special committee that was convened to look at natural resource performance measures and specific to this agency. They were adopted by the Progress Board, and this is what we have today.
Amen.
That's what has happened.
You betcha. You've done what you were told to do.
And are they perfect?
Yeah.
No. Are there other things that we measure? This agency measures all kinds of aspects of fish and wildlife resources. We have a running account of Columbia River runs from 1938. I can show you specific to species, run timing, numbers, over that length of time. We have similar information for fish in the Willamette. We also have that type of information for many of our coastal streams, particularly where we have hatchery and wild fish programs. I think we can, from what we have available, if we identify something that you want measured, we can probably hand it over to you. That we've already got it. And I'm more than willing to do that, because I want to get the most out of my dollar that I can to provide the people of Oregon the fish and wildlife management that they deserve. So the book's open. Let's rewrite the performance measures. It's fine with me.
Representative Dinkfelder?
Well, and I have a question pertaining to that, because, you know, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's hard to say in 2 years have you recovered a stock due to a couple of measures that you've implemented, and is there an opportunity to have performance measures that span a longer time frame? I mean, we're doing that with the coastal coho assessment to some extent, which has been, what, looking over the past 10 years? Well, I think.
Chair Krieger, Representative Dingfelder, we have information on coastal coho that goes back 50 to 100 years even in some aspects of it.
But the assessment itself was looking at the Oregon, since the Oregon plan's been implemented, is that correct?
We took a look at several factors with respect to coastal coho. From the time that it was from the time that the species was listed, a downturn to what it's done today was the principal area that was being examined. When the population was at its very lowest point in the mid to late 90s to what it is currently today, we had data available at that time and prior to that to illustrate the persistence and resiliency of that fish stock to rebound under favorable conditions.
Representative Schaffer?
Well, no, I have just a follow-up. So I guess, you know, this is part of the frustration with performance measures that are based on a two-year biennial budget that span a longer time frame. And I know that we're just starting this process, but it may be something you want to keep in mind about having sort of short-term and long-term performance measures, because there are some aspects that can't be just measured it's more on a cumulative basis, you know, that we really need to be looking at some of these improvements, especially for some of the listed stocks. So I don't know. I'll be happy to talk to you. Maybe we can come up with some ideas, Lindsay.
Chair Krieger, Representative Dingfelder, and that's why I referenced the information we have on the Columbia River. We have detailed information that goes back to 1938 to present day. And that evaluates what's taking place with the different fish species in the system and the fish that are returning. To evaluate the performance of a fishery or a wildlife population on a two-year base doesn't give you but a snapshot in time. That's it. If you want to institutionalize a performance measure, it needs to be done something on the order of 10-plus years. Then you start to identify the trend. If we keep changing the performance measures, I can't deliver it.
Lindsay, the snapshot on time also doesn't... How do you show, as we said before, the variables that caused it to take place in 1 year? You can't do it. You can't even identify.
And Chair Krieger, that's where it's important that your fisheries managers detail assumptions or predictions of what caused that population shift to occur.
If I might, I think that it's important, again, that we are going through another thorough review of performance measures, probably more thorough than we did last session, and certainly the hope is that when we land on some measures, that they will be measured over time, and you don't really get 10-year data until you start with measuring year one. And that's what we're trying to do at this point, is really trying to get some measures in place that tell us something. And the part of the control over the agency on what happens with the data is kind of a never-ending debate in working with performance measures. It really is. It's some measures and some agencies, what they do, like the Department of Transportation, they have a direct link to condition of lane miles. With something like fish, this department does, it's much harder to pinpoint what their impact is on the change in populations, for example. But that doesn't alleviate us from maybe wanting to know what is going on with populations anyways. And the department can certainly explain when they see variances of what some of the variables are that affect that change in trying to explain it. And hopefully that there would be some understanding on the part of this committee, certainly I think there would be, that they have very little control over probably what happens. Doesn't mean that we don't want to know what's happening. And Representative Dingfelder, just to get back to your point about the Oregon plan, I know that the co-chairs want to have some kind of similar measures across Oregon plan agencies, and I believe that you'll see, again, for this agency, they want to have the same measures that OWEB has on the delisting in this agency. They also were interested in seeing a measure of non-listing decisions, because it's, as you heard the director of OWEB talk about, sometimes it's also good to talk about the effort they put into, in essence, a non-event. So
I think that there certainly is probably more work that could be done on coordinating what happens with Oregon Plan and Oregon Plan performance measures, and I know that the co-chairs are certainly interested in doing that to the extent possible. I might just also mention that they were interested in having the agency track the economic impact, as the director talked about earlier, from commercial fishing, sport fishing, hunting, and you might even want to consider throwing the wildlife watching in there too. And certainly any other suggestions that the committee has, they certainly would be willing to listen to. And I think there was just an overall concern with this agency that, A, for the size of the agency, they had very few measures, and B, that, you know, based on just a quick review of what other states were measuring, there was some room for improvement.
Thank you.
Yeah, this is real specific. It's talking of the drought, Mount Hood's pretty drier than normal. They're going back to 1938, are there data showing you how these fish runs will respond, and for example, at the Sandy or Clackamas River, in conditions on Mount Hood just comparable to what they are today? Do you have anything like that?
Chair Krieger, Representative Schaufler, there may be some information in the narratives that speak to drought conditions specific to different watersheds. There is narrative specific to general conditions throughout the basin. But I can't recall anything specific just to the Clackamas or the Sandy, but there would be mention in the narrative about general drought conditions throughout the basins.
You mean the Columbia River Basin?
Yes, the Columbia or the Willamette. Because we could find ourselves in a drought condition in the Willamette system, but yet have a fairly good reserve of water in the Columbia Basin, just depending upon how the storm patterns are.
Senator Nelson.
So, performance measure number 4, you talk about natural fish populations. Performance measure number 5 is hatchery fish populations. What is the status of the... Wasn't there a judge in Eugene, a federal judge, that ruled that hatchery was the same as genetic... or genetically similar to natural, or there was no difference between what they called wild fish and natural fish? And does that, should we be looking at our, any of our standards or performance measures based upon that?
Chair Krieger, Senator Nelson, get ready for a very complex, long answer here.
Well, maybe we should wait.
I think you better wait.
He's
guilty.
Watch out.
That's
the Morgan
decision,
there,
and that's...
Boy, the
home.
Yeah, right.
It goes
very quickly, native fish, you have to think beyond your salmon and steelhead. All your trout species, all your other fish that are in the system as well. You know, I mean, I'm talking about your chubs and your suckers and your resident trout, anywhere from steelhead to salmon, sturgeon, etc. Those are all native fish populations. Your hatchery fish, with respect to the Hogan decision, was respective of comparing hatchery fish that were raised within a specific ESU where a listed fish was residing, and whether or not that hatchery fish was derived from the wild fish within that ESU, and that is what Judge Hogan ruled on, that since the hatchery fish within that the LC Basin originated from populations that extended within within the boundaries of the ESUs as defined by NOAA Fisheries, therefore the judge ruled that those fish should be considered one and the same. And but you still, that still doesn't get to the answer about native fish being monitored, which goes way beyond the issue of hatchery and wild stocks.
You're done? Okay. What do we have left to accomplish on performance measures, Director? Pretty well done with your piece of that.
We finished up the discussion, Chair. There were some questions by the committee members. I have concluded my presentation on performance measures, and Mr. Siebert had followed up with some recommendations as to what we might do in the future.
Okay, very good. Do you want to go ahead and start into prioritization? Paul, do you want to do that today, or should we save that until tomorrow?
Mr. Chair, Director, were you done with the agency overview part? Did you have
no, you're probably not, are you?
Not quite yet.
Okay.
We can sure pick up the pace here.
No. Let's go ahead and finish up the agency overview, because I think we'll have plenty of time tomorrow to finish up prioritization and reductions okay. list.
I'd like for you to turn to page 14 and 15 in your manual. There's something I want to illustrate a little bit. It has to do with the agency history in the last 10 years. And I'll admit maybe I'm going to brag a little bit here, but if you take a look at what the agency has accomplished in the last couple of years, there's 16 things listed under those agency history compared to 9 and 3 and 6 and 4 from previous bienniums. And if you take a look at the issues that this agency has engaged itself in with respect to fish and wildlife management, I think it's pretty fair to say that this is an agency that's at work. It was a statutory mandate. We've accomplished a number of things. In this last 2 years, in 2003-05, the sale of the building in Portland and the move to Salem, we were able to update the Bighorn Sheep Plan. The coastal coho assessment began, which has put us on the cutting edge of how do we look at a no-list decision or a down-list decision or a D-list decision of species. Columbia Basin Subbasin Plan development was completed. Construction of the Hatchery Research Center began. Development of a comprehensive statewide conservation policy was commenced. First hunting season on Columbia white-tailed deer adopted by the Fish and Wildlife Commission. And by the way, that species was delisted by the state in 1995, and finally delisted by the feds in 2003, I believe, if I recall correctly. And today we've been able to implement a season on the animal for Oregon citizens.
That's a real success story, mm-hmm. Lindsay, and should be the department should be congratulated for managing that well. Can you give us an update on the new hatchery project, by the way, which we're very interested in. This is members. If you're not familiar with this. This is the former Fall Creek Hatchery, which is now being transformed, shall we say, into a hatchery research center that will study mirroring nature in raising fish. And I think will have profoundly positive impacts in terms of really helping us manage hatcheries in the future for the benefit of all. And Lindsay, why don't you give us an update of where you are on this thing? And by the way, we are actually talking with another committee about possibly doing a field trip out there sometime first part of April. Is that right, Director Ball?
Chair Krupp, April 1.
I know it's April Fool's Day, but it won't be a joke. This is an outstanding project, and hopefully we'll be able to make that fit into our schedules to do that. Why don't you give us an update on that project, where we're at on it?
Funding came to build the hatchery as a result of the 2003 legislative session and also subsequent funding for the diversion point of the Fall Creek for hatchery water by the Restoration Enhancement Board of the Department of Fish and Wildlife. Construction has been completed on the fish ladder and diversion point at the upper end of the project area. Two of the four natural streams where you will be able to create a natural stream setting to study fish in their natural environment. There will be four of those built. Two of them have been completed. They're starting on the second two at this time. There has been demolition of some old hatchery buildings that were contaminated with asbestos, etc., that had to be dealt with. Those buildings have been removed. Construction has started on the main center. It's a two-story building. There's a conference room, two classrooms, a wet lab, dry lab, and a ultraviolet light treatment room for water in a controlled environment to raise fish in. where you disinfect water to make sure there's no diseases whatsoever for certain experiments. There's also a tank farm that it will be outside the conference center that will have about 80 tanks where family groups of fish can be raised and studied, where you'll cross fish from hatchery, 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 wild, wild, hatchery, wild, wild crosses. There are four raceways that from the old hatchery that are that were left intact, so a control study can be done at that facility, the conventional hatchery.
Thank you. Right there, will you be able to study the reproduction of salmon at drought, flood, and optimum conditions in those raceways?
Chair Krupp, Representative Schaffler, you can adjust the water flow in any of these streams. You can replicate a condition similar to what you might find in a certain stream. The hard part will be setting the temperature. We may have some trouble setting a specific temperature for the water, but with some engineering, that could probably be accomplished too. But it will be as much of a mirror image in the wild setting as we can possibly make it.
I'm just curious, are you going to shade those streams for water temperature issues?
There's all kinds of ways to shade the stream, mechanically shaded, where they'll be given open periods of daylight and marginal periods of daylight, etc. There'll be ways to control that electronically and in relationship to the photo period of the day as well. It'll be completed in service by July 1 of this year. We're on target with respect to our timelines, and we're within our budget, and we don't foresee any kind of a late opening. So July 1, there'll be water running through it, and we should start to have some projects in on the ground working. It's a partnership with Oregon State University. A couple of reasons for that. One, by partnering with academia, we can attract what I see as the world's, I'm not underestimating this, the world's best and brightest in the way of scientists in fish aquaculture. Oregon State has sent out a notice of the opening for a science director. We had 19 applicants from around the world apply for that job. There are four candidates that will be going before a final interview here in the next couple of weeks, and hopefully we will have a science director for the facility come April 1.
And Director Ball, there is no facility like this in the world, is there?
Chair Krupp, members of the committee, I don't know of one, and neither does anyone else at this time.
Senator Nelson.
It may not be the same type of thing, but the tribes in my part of the country have been working on this for about 15 or 20 years, and have restored runs to the Umatilla River and restoring runs to the Walla Walla, maybe using some of the same process. But when I saw them first, they were using blue tarp and plastic pipes and things like that to recreate these conditions. They didn't have the ability of the money from the state to do it. But if you want to see a successful program, I can show you one in Umatilla County that's been in operation for 20 years. We're fishing right off the bridge in Pendleton as it runs right down through the Umatilla. So, it's a wonderful thing. I don't want to take that anything away from you guys. But there's other folks out there that are working on this, too, and they're very successful. And I want to give my tribe some recognition, too.
Yeah, well, point well taken, Senator. And yes, they have. The tribes have done an outstanding job in some of their streams. And we've had some great programs in the past that have assisted also. Hatch boxes comes to mind, even though they've been somewhat controversial over a period of years and really aren't in play much anymore. It's too bad. I think that's another piece of the puzzle of creating healthier natural fish runs. And anyway, that's my editorial comment. Senator Nelson, another comment?
This tribe's called gravel to gravel. I don't know what the fish and wildlife calls them, rather than concrete to concrete.
Well, one of the great things about us going out to the Hatchery Research Center on April 1st is we'll get a chance to see those completed raceways. in terms of how they've mimicked nature in terms of the stream beds and those and wood debris and those types of things. I'm actually looking forward, and I'm looking forward to the results that this project will produce for us, because it may be. I really believe it is the cutting edge, and I think that it will help us understand better how we can raise hatchery fish and, frankly, put this controversial debate to rest about hatchery versus natural. And I say natural because I don't believe there are any wild salmon out there anymore, at least in the lower 48. After all, 70 years of hatchery programs, I kind of doubt it. But at any rate, I'm looking forward to this. I think it's an outstanding project, and I've been highly in favor of it from day one. I think it's probably some of the best money we will ever have spent in this state on this issue. And I think it'll pay dividends for generations to come. Anyway, please continue with your general overview.
Chair Krupp, members of the committee, for your review, too, if you look at number 8 in your appendix, you'll find a briefing material on the Hatchery Research Center. Chair Krupp, also I want to mention, too, and we'll move off our historic perspective, but another thing that I think is important to note, and oftentimes it's overlooked, there are candidate species that come along from time to time for listing consideration. And the agency in the last 4 years has prevented a listing of the Klamath Mountain Province Steelhead, Red Band Trout in our state, sage grouse and mountain quail, all of which could have had quite a serious impact to a lot of our land-based industries. And in all of those, Oregon was truly a leader in developing the data and maintaining the data to be able to show U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and NOAA fisheries that the species did not deserve listing. And I think that speaks well of what this agency is capable of accomplishing. And the people in it. We have some of the best scientists, I think, in fish and wildlife today.
Yes, Representative
Dinkfeller. May I ask a question before we leave the agency history portion? And that is under the 0305, Lindsay, the first bullet point. Can you provide us with an update, maybe a little more in depth about the move and if we realized any cost savings from that move? Because I heard a lot about it beforehand, and I got a tour of the building, which was great. But did we actually save money? And if so, where does that money go if there are cost savings?
Chair Krupp, Representative Dingfelder, we sold the building for a profit after we paid off the certificate of participation, et cetera, of about $3 million. I'm giving you round figures here. Deputy Director Chris Couch can give you some very specific information, but I'll speak in rounded terms. We were directed in Senate Bill 50 of 2001 to use proceeds from the sale of the building to affect the move of the agency. And there were a lot of people who thought we would probably spend beyond the $3 million of proceeds that we picked up. And we'd have to come back to E-Board and ask for more money to affect the move. But I had some very sharp people with respect to how to stretch that dollar out. And we were able to save $1.6 million of the $3 million on the move. We only spent $1.4 to move the agency. We are in a leased building at the corner of Cherry Avenue and Parkway. We lease it from a private developer here in Salem, as was directed in the bill. And the $1.6 million is held in a special account in the wildlife, currently in the wildlife fund of the agency. The reason we've held on to that money was when we noticed that we weren't going to spend all the $3 million, the Senate Bill 50 directed us to deliver that money to the general fund. If we deliver that money to the general fund, we stand to lose $25 million of federal funds that are available to us through U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And the reason for that is the money that we invested in the building in Portland was other fund, license and tag dollars. And the federal agencies have a clause that requires the agencies to not allow any of the license and tag fees to revert back to the general fund. If they do, then they will cease payment or granting of the Dingell Johnson Pittman Robertson money, which amounts to about $25 million a year to this state. So consequently, where we are is that we introduced a legislative concept this session. It had a hearing in House Ag Natural Resources in Representative Patty Smith's committee. We would wish that that money remain in our wildlife fund within the agency, be allowed to roll into our ending balance. It's not budgeted in the governor's recommended budget. It's sitting there, not allocated for anything at this time. Certainly, if, as I mentioned in my testimony before Representative Smith, it's money that's available for this legislature to decide what they want to do with. But my issue is I don't want to jeopardize $25 million for $1.6 million.
Sure.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, just for your information, I believe the bill has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means on it, so you'll be dealing with that issue at some point in the near future, I would imagine.
And also, so you might understand, about half of that money is derived from hunting license and tag sales. The other half comes from angling license and tag sales. It's just almost a... The money that's generated by both fishing and hunting is almost an even split. So about $800,000 would be hunting, about $800,000 would be angling.
I guess we'll be discussing it further at some point.
Indeed we shall. Indeed we shall. Thank you, Director. Why don't you continue in the last 10 minutes before we conclude today's hearing?
Mr. Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry. Senator.
Thank you. Representative Dingfeller hit the same bullet point that I hit and marked here and wanted to ask a few questions about. My memory of this move is a little different, I guess, than yours. And it wasn't because of saving money or not saving money and what building you're working out of. There were some issues inside the agency that move was made for, in my memory. I was here during that session. And it's my understanding that there was a pretty big upheaval for a lot of people in the department when that move was suggested and forced upon the department. People lived in Portland for a long time, felt uncomfortable moving, and talking about commuting was difficult for some of them. There were a lot of issues involved and issues within the department as far as transparency and how things were functioning. My sense is that it has improved, but I'm wondering how that affected the morale of your department. And if you feel that after you've made the move now that you are functioning at a higher level with more transparency in your budgeting and more control of your agency.
Chair Krupp, Senator Bates, the move came about as a result of several things that were taking place in the agency. You are correct about that aspect. The savings was of the money came as a result of affecting the move. But what forced the move to be a subject was the fact that the agency had delivered a budget to the governor, and the governor had delivered a budget to the legislature that was wrong. It was $7 million wrong. The agency was represented to have more money than it actually had. It had been borrowing money to meet payroll from the Treasury. The previous director had come under fire for several issues within the agency. He left. That director left on February 15th of 2001, and I arrived February 16th, 2001. And the move issue caught a lot of people in a state of dismay. What we did internally was start teaching people how to write resumes, how to take job interviews, how to search for jobs in the Portland area. We held several meetings internally, Senator, where I explained to people that they needed to take control of their situation. To look at this in a positive light instead of a negative light, not to wait for a period of about 2 years for the move to come about, and then find themselves in an unbearable situation personally. Initially, I tracked several of the employees who left the agency early on in the fall of 2001 and early 2002, and I found that about 18 people left the agency, found better jobs, and then the whole mass exodus of state retirements and everything else happened, and I quit keeping track. The commute after we moved on August 16th, 2003, people started to make the commute. There were people who were encouraged about the building itself, the facility, how nice it was, but some found that the commute was not bearable for them, and they started looking for other employment in the Portland metro area where near their homes. Many of our people, to their surprise, found that the commute time was shorter than what it was living in Portland and trying to commute within Portland. And so,
different problem, folks, as I go there.
Yeah, there were some accused of, why are you getting home so early? You never used to.
Oh my God.
I think. And even to this day, as of this week, one employee I was notified about this morning found employment in her hometown of St. Helens, and she won't be working for us here in the near future. So there's some of that change still taking place, but I also think we did it in a pretty respectful way and in an informed way. It certainly was not easy for some folks. I certainly don't want anyone on this committee to think that. But I can't think of how we might have done it better. I can tell you this. At our location today, the public stops at the agency. We have free parking for the people. It's easy to get access to the building. The first 6 days that we were open for business, I kept track of that. We sold 1,800 licenses across our counter. That means 300 people were coming to our office each day. It's not uncommon in the recreation season, particularly for the coastal communities, to see a boat in the parking lot, someone in doing business with us. When we were in Portland, number one complaint was, well, I can't find you, and when I do find you, I can't park, and if I can park, it costs me $10. You know, what kind of an outfit are you running here? and so I think as far as reaching out to the public, it's been an advantage. I think that's probably what we ought to be doing.
Well, and it certainly has been an advantage in terms of your interaction with us and your agency personnel interaction with us on the legislative side, which is one of Senator Bates, your memory is quite correct. That is one of the reasons that we forced this to happen, was because we felt that, especially given, frankly, the indiscretions that I felt some people should have gone to jail for, given those indiscretions, we wanted a closer relationship with the department. And I think that's paid off. There's a department under your leadership, and those of your team has done some amazing things, in my opinion. That doesn't mean you get a free get-out-of-jail card here, you understand, but you've done a great job. Representative Schaffer and then Representative Krieger.
Logistically, I understand it, and I can tell you it's half a distance, but I'd rather commute from Happy Valley to Salem than Happy Valley to Hillsborough, even though Hillsborough is a shorter distance. So I can appreciate that. And it's a beautiful building, and I would get some. I understand some of the folks don't like those taxidermy animals out front, but I'd put them out front for everybody to see it. But my question is, I understand we don't own that building. Why didn't we buy a building? Is there some savings where, I can't believe over the long run we would save some money purchasing a property rather than leasing one.
Chair Krupp, Representative Schaffer, there was a lot of discussion about that at the time. There was a desire to have the department located on the Capitol Mall. Consequently, that the last building that was placed on the Capitol Mall, which is the North Mall building where parks and water resources are now located and housed, that planning started in 1985, happened in 2003.
There's my mall.
So much for efficiencies and quick move.
And so, consequently, as a, as an effort to outsource and to help local business, the legislature felt it would be best if we found a building that it was not housed at this time and have it retrofitted for us, or to have one built. We put a notice out that we were looking for a building. We looked at, if I recall, there were 15 finalists as to locations. All had different problems associated with them and the criteria that were just set up. And Jack Fox from White Oak Development was the winner, you might say, on the bid. And he built the building in record time, and we moved in August of 2003.
Very good. Representative Krieger, one last comment, and we need to go.
Well, I think one thing, I think this record bowl is restored to the great benefit of Oregon, the trust in the agency. And that took a lot of work.
Yes.
There was an effort within the agency with personnel that fought that. I mean, you don't have to comment that to it. I will. But if there were some people left, fine. The state of Oregon is better off without them. Right out, and I don't give a damn who it is. The other thing is,
hey, some of them were my constituents.
That's fine. But having a respect for people is something that the agency needed to do. I think they got accountability back, and I think that they now know who their constituent base is they serve. They serve the people of Oregon and the people that foot the bill.
You're here. Point well taken. And that's a great concluding comment. Thank you for your participation today. We'll be back tomorrow. We are adjourned.